Good morning. The time is now 8:31 a.m. on January 22nd, 2025, and I call the meeting of the Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologists Examiners to order. Ms. Michelson, would you please call the roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Okay, we have quorum. We may proceed.
Thank you. Our next agenda item is approval of minutes. So the November 20th, 2024 Complaint Screening Committee regular session and executive session minutes. Dr. Seidman is recused from this item. I will make a motion to approve the minutes as drafted.
Second.
Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed, the motion carries.
Dr. Medina, did you second that motion?
Yes, Well, I made the motion.
He made the motion.
Oh, you made, okay, thank you. Okay, thank you.
Yes, I made the motion, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you.
And then the motion, yeah. So before discussing the cases scheduled for review today, I will be sharing important information for everyone in attendance. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to Arizona Revised Statutes 32-2081, Section H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website pursuant to Arizona Revised Statute 32-2081 H1. Upon a vote of a majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38-431.03, sections A2, to review confidential records, or subsection A3, to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney, Ms. Jeannie Galvin. Please be aware that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based upon parties present. Please use initials only for patients, children, and the complainant. In addition, do not state specific diagnoses in open session. Instead, please state the diagnosis on record. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential, and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. A person or a representative of a person who has filed a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement to the committee up to 5 minutes, only when prompted by the chair. Additionally, the licensee or respondent who is the subject of the complaint will also have an opportunity to make a brief 5-minute statement, only when prompted by the chair. The committee may also have questions for the complainant or respondent after their statement is made. Please note that only individuals directly involved in a complaint, which are the complainant and respondent, may address the committee and make a statement. If the committee wishes to hear from any other party, it will make this request during the case review. For everyone in attendance today, please ensure that your audio remains on mute. When prompted by the committee to speak, the complainant, respondent, and their legal representative may unmute themselves at that time. Please note that individuals in attendance who speak out without committee approval will be warned twice by the chair not to interrupt. If the interruption continues after the second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and not permitted to re-enter the meeting. So the first complaint scheduled for review today is case number 25-10 against Rona Lavitt. Dr. Stewart, would you please provide a brief overview of this complaint since you are the lead?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. Complaint number 25-10 against Dr. Ronald Lavitt, PhD, holds license number 191, was licensed in Arizona beginning in 1970. The complaint stems from a contentious custody battle where the mother had full custody of the son, and the father sought to receive medical records and also sought to receive the mother's confidential materials as she filled out information sheets for Dr. Lavitt to conduct the evaluation of the son. This evaluation was ultimately not completed by Dr. Lavitt. The complainant filed a motion with the court to order Dr. Lavitt to provide the information. Dr. Lavitt, on September 11th, 2024, submitted a motion to the court himself seeking to have the complainant's subpoena quashed. And that was indeed happened on October 11th, 2024 by the court. So it was quashed. So those are the key issues in this case. I'd entertain any questions if anyone has any.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Is complainant RS present? If so, you please unmute yourself and state your initials only for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement. Is complainant RS present? Okay. Doesn't look like it.
Madam Chair, the complainant had previously relayed that he would be attending, but I don't see him here today. If he's okay. One of the individuals that called in, he would need to unmute his line. So, RS, if you are present, please unmute your phone. And if not, then we would go to the licensee and his attorney.
Okay, doesn't look like it. So, Dr. Lavitt, are you and your attorney present? If so, you may unmute both yourselves and state your full names for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Good morning. This is Attorney Cynthia Patain for Dr. Lavitt, and Dr. Lavitt is right next to me. I'm so sorry about that bright light. Dr. Lavitt is right here, and if it's okay with you, I'll just make a brief statement, and then he's available to answer any questions. I don't really have much to add to the summary, very honestly. This is a complaint that arises over a records request. Dr. Lavitt was retained by mother to perform an assessment of her child, and she completed an intake form, and she gave Dr. Lavitt records from other doctors. And then father asked for a copy of that intake sheet that mother had prepared and copies of the records that mother had given Dr. Lavitt. Dr. Lavitt said he would not produce the records until after the assessment. That's his typical practice. And frankly, he's never had anyone ask for the intake form before the assessment. But he said he was willing to produce those so long as there was no confidential information in the intake form that mother wouldn't want father to have, like, I don't know, her address or something like that. But as long as there was no confidentiality issue with producing the intake form to father, Dr. Lavitt said, I will give you copies of the records that mom gave me and the intake form, but not until after the assessment. So father then filed this complaint with you guys, and Dr. Lavitt then withdrew from the case over the concern that whatever his assessment was would potentially not be accepted by father because of the complaint, and it just muddied things too much and created potential conflict. So he never performed the assessment. And he did not, he has not produced the intake form or the copies of the records that the, of other doctors that were given to him by mother. The statute that father relies on, that he, asserts require Dr. Lavitt to give him those records, does not apply to the non-original records like the intake form and, or the records that were given to Dr. Lavitt from other doctors. And it doesn't apply to an intake form. An intake form is not a medical record. But nonetheless, Dr. Lavitt was going to give him those items. The statute says you're required to, or parents can have access to the records from doctors. And the custodian of records has a reasonable amount of time to produce those records. So there was nothing requiring Dr. Lavitt to give him all those records before the assessment. As I said, he was going to give him those records after the assessment, but the assessment never took place. So that's where we are. There's been no violation of a statute, a regulation, or any other guidelines, ethics, nothing of that nature here. And we are hoping that the complaint will be dismissed. And as I said, Dr. Lavitt is right next to me. If you have any questions, thank you.
Thank you. No worries. Thank you for being here.
I have never seen the boy. I have never seen the mother. I have never seen the father. So I haven't evaluated anyone. I received one record from a Dr. Lemoru, who's a forensic psychiatrist, and the mother's attorney had already sent him that record. I have taken no family history. The mother, it was pointed out that I had a family history. I have no family history from the mother, so it's just an ordinary intake form. But I was not going to share it because, one, she had sole custody. Two, I didn't know if there was an order of protection or some kind of order that would prohibit the information from going to him. So I wasn't going to give this at the beginning of an evaluation. Usually people want to know all the records you get at the end, because the father could have sent records, the mother could have, and then after you do the evaluation, people look at it and see what you've used and how you've used it and the conclusions. It's really very simple. And I believe I followed the standard procedures, the law as stated, and I'm hoping that this is dismissed.
Thank you, Dr. Lavitt. Committee members, are there any questions for Dr. Lavitt? Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Lavitt, thank you so much for being with us this morning. It's your understanding that at the time the mother made the request to evaluate her son, that she had full legal custody of the child. Is that correct?
Yes.
And in terms of, it's your understanding that because she had full legal custody to consent, that you did not need to release any records to the non-governing parent, to the father. Is that correct?
Well, I wasn't going to release it at that time, but when the evaluation was over, at that point, I think both parents have a right to see the records and review what the procedures were and did, because both parents would maybe provide me with records. But at the point where I haven't seen anyone, and I haven't talked to the mother, I haven't talked to the father, there was nothing for me to provide to anyone. And the one record I did have was already sent to the father. So I was at ground zero, so to speak.
Okay. I have no further questions at this point, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, Dr. Lavitt.
Hello.
Dr. Lavitt, how long have you been doing cases like this in your career?
35 years. So.
Thank you. That's all I need to know. Thank you. Appreciate it.
point. Okay. The committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys, representing licensees, or any other individuals. Dr. Stewart, would you please begin the deliberation since you are the lead?
Excuse me, Dr. I'm sorry to interrupt difficulties, so I apologize for my delay, but I thought I was going to be able to make a statement. Would that be after the deliberation?
Okay. I will allow it. You may make a 5-minute statement, and the committee may have questions for you, RS. Please use initials when referring to yourself. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Pardon me, I'm having technical difficulties, but I have a statement that I'd like to read. Okay. I apologize for my delay. I would just like to read the state statute 25-403.06, parental access to prescription medication and records. A, unless otherwise provided by the court of law on a reasonable request, both parents are entitled to have equal access to prescription medications, documents, and other information concerning the child's education, physical, mental, moral, and emotional health, including medical, school, police, court, and other records directly from the custodian of records or from the other parent. B, a person who does not comply with the reasonable request shall reimburse the requesting parent for court costs, attorney's fees, and attorney's fees incurred by that parent to force compliance to this section. C, a parent with joint legal custody shall not designate one pharmacy or single location, only the source of the child's prescription medication without agreement of the other parent. D, a parent who attempts to restrict the release of access, the release of documents or information by the custodian, or attempts to withhold prescription medication without prior court order is subject to appropriate legal sanctions. That's Arizona state statute. And after requesting very politely 3 times via email, Dr. Lavitt refused to provide access to my son's records. My son was provided an unknown number of documents. It has been proven that other documents or perhaps the same documents, I don't know, included false information about my son that was provided by either my ex-wife attorney, who I was told was the person who contacted this Dr. Lavitt. Can I use her name? Which is that because the emails and correspondence that I provided include her name, and that's a big part of this issue is this attorney, and I'll just say her name, you can redact it, Sandra Slayton. I asked many times to determine what information was provided to Dr. Lavitt. I wanted to know prior to his evaluation to see if his ADHD has been addressed and he's provided accommodations, if his IEP had been provided, if the proper medical records had been provided, false information and misrepresented information had been provided to other physicians and providers in the past, as well as to the court, the family court and Arizona Superior Court. And I did not know what bias this provider had been given. Also, I requested through subpoena my records, as well as email correspondence between the attorney and Dr. Lavitt, since it was admitted that Dr. Lavitt was originally contacted by this attorney. I was denied it all, and then they filed a motion to quash my subpoena, which I don't understand why that would be something that they would be desperate to prevent me from seeing what kind of a conversation happened between this attorney. As it has come out, I'll be filing an additional complaint with the board with a replacement physician, a psychologist, who has been given information that I have been able to see, and they claim it was the same information that was given to Dr. Lavitt. I have no way of verifying that. That information did include false statements and false information that was used in a negative way to mislead this next physician who you will be hearing about on a future complaint. That is what I would like to communicate. I just would like to see my son's records and those email communications.
Okay, thank you, RS. Are there any questions for RS from the committee members at this point? Okay, so the committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is a time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any other individual. Dr. Stewart, would you please begin the deliberation since you are the lead?
Yes, Dr. Medina, thank you. It seems like the mother in this case had sole authorization to consent to medical care and to approve same. And it seems like it's a contentious issue. Yet again, we see parents wanting to litigate here in the board something that they should be in the courts litigating with each other and not here as a complaint against a psychologist. I guess I have some questions for the Associate Attorney General, Ms. Gavin, regarding what is and is not appropriate and what is in the statute governing our situation. I don't know if I can ask you these questions right now in open session, or do we need to go into executive session for legal advice?
When I provide you legal advice, it is my recommendation that we do that in executive session.
I move that we go into executive session in order to receive legal advice.
Second.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Motion passes. Okay, we are all back, so I'll hand it back over to you, Dr. Stewart, to continue deliberations.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. My opinion, my practice etiquette is that the intake information is not really attached to the rendering of my evaluation of someone, and so I'm not seeing that intake form as a medical record, so I'm not seeing that. And then the father's subpoena had been quashed by the court, so I'm not seeing that Dr. Lavitt needs to turn over any records because the evaluation was not done.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I would agree with my colleague, Dr. Stewart.
I believe that Dr. Leavitt performed reasonably in responding to the complainant about needing a reasonable time if the service was going to be provided. And since the service wasn't provided, there was no medical record to provide. So that's how I'm thinking about this.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Seidman. I am in agreement. Yes, Dr. Stewart?
I move that the case be dismissed.
Second.
Okay. I agree with that. So all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
None opposed? The motion carries. This case will be dismissed. Thank you. Let's see, motion carries. So complaint regarding 2510 regarding Dr. Leavitt has been dismissed. The licensee and complainant will be notified in writing by board staff in the near future regarding the committee's decision today. Moving on to the next case. The next complaint scheduled for review today is case number 2516 against Jeffrey Mintert. I am the lead in this case, and I will provide the summary. So this is summary for complaint 25-16 against Jeffrey Mintert, PhD, holder of license number 5452, issued on June 2021. In September 2024, complainant YM filed a complaint against Dr. Mintert, alleging that Dr. Mintert attended the appointment without YM's prior knowledge of or consent, and that she endured mental health gaslighting by Dr. Mintert, and that Dr. Mintert used intimidation tactics to force YM's consent for an undesired pain medication regimen change, and that his progress note contains false information and fails to include important information about YM's medical issues. Dr. Mintert submitted his response to the complaint in a timely manner. In his response, Dr. Mintert explained that YM's appointment in the pain center was scheduled with a nurse practitioner. During YM's initial appointment in August 2024, Dr. Mintert was asked by the treating nurse to attend an initial appointment with YM as part of the co-management of her pain care. This is standard practice for the center. This practice is always implemented with consent of the patient, which YM provided at the time without issue. During YM's initial visit at the center, she did not indicate that she had a prior history of trauma with males and wanted to receive services from female providers only. Dr. Mintert maintained that he adhered to the established guidelines and protocols of the center and offered his expertise to enhance YM's quality of life and functional status. Dr. Mintert maintains that at no point during the appointment did YM indicate discomfort with having a male provider, and that the female nurse practitioner was present during the appointment. And that concludes my summary to the committee. Is complainant YM present? If so, please unmute yourself and state your initials only for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement. Go ahead, YM.
YM, I arrived at the Phoenix VA Hospital with an 18-month established and effective pain management regimen. I had previously gone 2 years without effective pain management. My regimen includes non-opiate by-mouth medications, as well as topicals, heat cold therapy, and stretches. I have historically abused alcohol as a coping mechanism following two physical...
YM, please feel free not to disclose any confidential health information on the record. That would be your right not to have to disclose that information. The board has everything in its files.
Okay, but if I do, it's okay? because I prepared a statement so that I could stay on track, and I didn't.
Yep, it's up to you. Just don't feel obligated.
Okay, yes, ma'am, I want to. I will just want to read it because I'm nervous and I just want to read it.
That's okay. That's all right.
Like it is. Okay, so I start back over. I arrived at the Phoenix VA hospital with an 18-month established and effective pain management regimen. I had previously gone 2 years without effective pain management. My regimen includes non-opiate by-mouth medications, topicals, heat and cold therapy, and stretches. I have historically abused alcohol as a coping mechanism following two violent physical and sexual assaults. My last alcohol consumption is greater than 4 years ago. I regularly pass drug tests and visit with my psychiatrist. On August the 23rd, having verified previously that I would have a female provider, I arrived at the pain management clinic for my appointment. Dr. Minter came to the aid of his coworker who had called for a show of force without provocation. When Dr. Minter entered the room, he became the most highly educated and senior employed specialist in the room. He received my consent to his presence because I was utterly afraid to say no, to conceal the fact that a show of force against me had been initiated without cause, and to justify Dr. Minter's presence, my one female provider visit was changed to a co-disciplinary visit. During my appointment on August the 23rd, Dr. Minter asserted I would relapse within 5 years were I to continue using Tramadol, according to the many studies he read. However, Dr. Minter did not discuss the 2022 most recent CDC clinical practical guidelines for opioid prescriptions. The CDC recommends a daily cap of opioid use of 120 mmEs per day. My use of Tramadol 50 milligrams twice daily is equivalent to 20 mmEs, five times less than the CDC recommends. I declined to return to the clinic for any reason, including tapering. Dr. Minter had invalidated and dismissed my reported structural and functional pain levels. He could have advocated for me and spoken with my PCP about updating my 2022 MRI or referring me to orthopedics or physical therapy. Alternatively, he documented my symptoms were evidently somatic. The statement is not only false, but without objective documentation, it is also negative and harmful. It is a demeaning stigmatization that incorrectly inferred I have a substance abuse disorder. In closing, Dr. Minter had a duty to use his judgment and could decide not to recommend Tramadol. However, he also had a duty to protect me from additional emotional distress, but he did not. In fact, on September the 3rd, 2024, Dr. Minter and others held and documented a case conference at the pain clinic regarding my psychological care. The participants discussed the distress I expressed, which they caused on August the 23rd. I was neither informed of nor invited to the case conference. Dr. Minter had a duty to document objective, true, and complete information in my medical records. He had a duty to use objective standard assessment tools, such as an opiate risk tool or a DSM-5 substance use abuse assessment tool. He did not. Instead, Dr. Minter feigned empathy to elicit an emotional response from me. When that didn't work, he resorted to false, misleading, and incomplete documentation. I left that appointment confused, angry, helpless, distressful, fearful, and with a significant increase in my PTSD symptoms. I would have suffered from withdrawals from Tramadol abruptly and unsafely had I not sought care elsewhere. Apart from the VA, I received a thorough chronic pain assessment, updated imaging, and a referral to orthopedics. On November the 20th, the orthopedic physician assistant confirmed two diagnoses of spinal deformities, She also referred me to physical therapy for 66 visits for an evaluation and treatment. My pain is not evidently somatic, as Dr. Mentor documented, and in no form did I acknowledge any connection between my pain and my mood at that appointment. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, YM. Committee members, are there any questions for YM? And I actually do have a couple of questions, YM, for you. So you were referred to the center by your PCP at the VA?
Yes.
Okay. So were they to take over your pain management treatment?
Yes. But I didn't know that at the time, but the answer to that question is yes.
Okay. And so after that appointment, do you know if anything was going to change then? Was anything changing with your treatment?
I never went back. I haven't gone back to either one, the PCP or the pain management person. I simply cannot.
Okay. Then return. Okay. Those were my questions. Thank you, YM. Any other questions for YM? Yes, Dr. Stewart.
I just wanted to thank YM for being here this morning. And
thank you.
I think it takes a great deal of courage to stick up for yourself sometimes, especially when you're in a large organization of healthcare, such as the VA or other systems. And I certainly applaud you for doing that. I don't have any questions specific other than what YM has already indicated.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Okay. Dr. Mintert, are you and your attorney present?
Yes.
If so, you may unmute both yourselves and state your full names for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Good morning. Yes, I'm here, Jeff Mintert.
And I'm Sarah Stark, counsel for Dr. Mintert. And I'll make a couple of brief comments. So obviously we provided a written response, and a lot of the information I think is addressed in that. But I also just wanted to point out too that a lot of the concerns expressed by complainant here appear to be based around prescribing and medication management, which is all obviously outside of the scope of what Dr. Mintert's role was. In addition, there were a few opportunities where Dr. Mintert asked not only the nurse practitioner who was involved in this case, but also complainant whether it was okay for him to join and be involved in the appointment. And, you know, it was expressed that there was no concern and he was invited in. So those are my comments. Obviously, if the committee members have any questions for us, we're available to answer. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Mintert?
Yes.
Yes, Dr. Stewart. This is for the committee members. Thank you. Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Mintert, thanks for being here. Ms. Stark, as always, thank you for engaging with the board. Dr. Mintert, the subtlety of someone with the history that YM has and her preference for female practitioners to interact with her, and feeling caught and feeling intimidated, sometimes that can occur even when there's no intention of intimidation. And I guess I'll put a question mark at the end of that statement. If you can maybe address that, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. So I agree that you cannot always know going into an interaction how your own stimulus value is going to impact the person that you're interacting with. And because YM had made it clear that there was a surprise that I was joining the appointment, as it was not originally scheduled as a co-disciplinary appointment, was why I had made additional efforts in obtaining the informed consent that I would typically obtain. And there was no indication that they wanted me to leave that appointment at the time. And so proceeded as I typically would in that appointment with the nurse practitioner. And the patient had also asked if it was all right if their daughter would be on speakerphone during the appointment, which of course I said was fine since we had the patient's consent to do that.
And Dr. Stewart, I just want to add to this was an initial appointment, so there wasn't a super robust history that the providers had at this point either. So it's not like they had a chart with a bunch of information and they had been treating this person for a long time. So they were learning about the situation at that initial appointment as well.
But taking the start, if I may have a follow up question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Dr. Minter, seeing what has transpired after that and YM's revelation this morning, what if you could look in your crystal ball, what would you have done differently? Knowing this now, what would you have done differently?
I guess looking back and with, like you said, looking into a crystal ball.
Yeah.
I felt like in that moment, I did my best I could of obtaining consent, which the patient provided. Hindsight is certainly 20/20. I never want someone that I'm working with to feel that way after an interaction with me, right. As you hopefully could imagine. It was very unfortunate to hear, to say the least, that that's how someone felt after interacting with me. So certainly if hindsight is 20/20, then I would not have been present for the appointment. However, with what I knew at the time and how it unfolded in the moment, I don't know that there's something that I would have done differently looking back, because in that situation, consent was given. They said it was fine for me to stay. And so I stayed. And my goal is to respect the patient's autonomy and not for me to decide to remove myself from the situation if they're saying that it's okay for me to be present.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Minter. I have no further questions right now, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And good morning, Dr. Minter and Ms. Stark. I'm curious about the customary and usual processes with the VA around scheduling and notifying the patient of, you know, who's going to be their provider. Can you speak to that just a little bit, please?
Absolutely. So typically, the patients who are coming in are going to know who they're meeting with, which, as I understand from looking at the notes, that was communicated to YM. And what happened on that particular Friday is that I have a physician colleague on the team who I'm typically in co-disciplinary appointments with on Friday mornings. But in this particular case, that provider was out of the office. And so in those situations, typically, because then that's what I'm scheduled to be doing, we will have the psychology team join the other medical colleagues who are not scheduled into co-disciplinary appointments, because really our clinic's preference is to do these initial consultation appointments as co-disciplinary appointments when we are able to. Mm-hmm. And so that was the reason that I was joining that appointment, even though it wasn't scheduled to be that way out of the gate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Madam Chair, is it okay if I follow up with another question? Dr. Minter, in looking back, I appreciate you retrospectively, you know, examining kind of what's occurred. I'm wondering about the analogies you used. Mm-hmm. They, you know, my just reading them, do you think those were appropriate, those two the analogies you used?
Happy to speak more to those. So the one analogy I believe that you're referring to, if I'm correct, is the one about brain imaging studies. Is that?
Yes.
Yeah. So one of the things that our team will typically talk about with patients is trying to help expand our understanding of pain. Chronic pain, of course, is an incredibly complex phenomenon that does not have a singular biomedical or biomechanical cause in most cases. And so what was I was attempting to be able to share with YM in that moment was that we know that pain does not exist in a physical biomedical vacuum, and that imaging studies have shown us that when the brain is activated for both emotional pain and physical pain, that it lights up in very similar ways, very similar pathways are involved. So the idea being that when people are experiencing pain, there's no question that the pain is real, and there's no question about validity of pain. It's more so that we're expanding our scope of understanding how pain works in the brain. So that's how I recall explaining that. I don't know if that's exactly what was captured in the complaint. Would you like me to pause there or speak to the second?
Well, yeah, the second one is a little bit, what I'm kind of looking at.
Okay. Because,
the way it reads, it's a little bit accusatory.
Agreed. And what I will say is I don't recall pitching it exactly as it's written. So here's how I would typically talk about this with a patient. And again, this is in support with the medical team present. I'm not making any recommendations about whether somebody should or should not be on medication or any dosage, et cetera. So in that particular case, what I was saying was that if you didn't wear your seatbelt and never got into a car accident, then you might conclude that like it's safe not to wear a seatbelt, that it's fine. But with opioids, the message was not, we think you're going to relapse, or we think that you're going to overtake these or misuse this medication anyway. But that long-term research has shown us that risk of things, including accidental overdose or other adverse events, is great. And so saying that it's been okay so far is not evidence to say that it is reasonable to continue. And the reason that that is being shared in that space is in providing more of that pain neuroscience education and education about these medications is, again, supporting the medical team, because their recommendation, of course, is going to be their recommendation. I have no sway over that. And our clinic's policy is that if we're going to take over opioid prescribing, the only way we're going to do that is with a well-established plan in place. And so my role is supporting the medical team in that discussion with the patient.
Right, and you repeat, I'm sorry, Dr. Minter, can you repeat the last statement you made, because it got cut out? I didn't understand it.
Was it the piece that I said that my role in that particular conversation is supporting the medical team in that information sharing with
them? So what you said right before. So if the medical team is going to take over.
Oh, if the medical team is going to take over opioid prescribing, that's what you're asking about, then they are only doing so with an established plan in place with the patient. An agreed upon plan, which was not arrived on in that appointment on that Friday.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Minter, looking back, and I think you've done an excellent job of explaining, kind of walking us through the VA system and what is not available for intake appointment, and what you intended to communicate to YM. But seeing YM's reaction to this, very personal, very visceral, very gut-wrenching. What's your reaction to that?
My reaction to that is, frankly, sadness, that that is the way that I was perceived that morning, and that that level of invalidation is what someone experienced. So I think that for me, I really would never hope, of course, that that's how somebody would feel after having that interaction with me, and really was struck by what was in there, because the idea of feigning empathy or gaslighting, like, that is so far from how I hope to be showing up with folks that I work with. So a lot of sadness that that's how I made someone else feel in interacting with me. And I I don't feel regret about what I did because I know what my intention was, but I certainly wish that things would have gone differently, even though I don't know what I would have done differently without knowing what I know now, if that makes sense.
Thank you. I have no further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. I do have a couple questions, Dr. Minchard. So I'm trying to understand, I guess, your role, but also like the use of those analogies. Is the goal, I mean, is the goal of the appointment to get the, in this case, YM to agree to stop taking tramadol? What was the role of those analogies?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So as I understand it, Nurse Practitioner Tillman and anybody on our medical team would not be restarting a medication, an opioid-based medication with a patient. And a lot of this is beyond my scope, but that's my role, is supporting them in that. And that VA guidelines and more national guidance has been to move away from the use of opioid medications for long-term use for chronic pain. So we're not the ultimate gatekeepers of access to that medication for the patients that we see. But if patients are choosing to work with our team, which of course is their choice, then they would not be like starting back up an opioid medication, staying on it long-term, typically is what I've seen. They are usually working with those veterans to move, a quote I've heard our team use is from pills to skills. And so really focusing on making that shift with patients because of the evidence of what happens being on these medications long-term in many cases. And so supporting the patient in a more active and functional quality of life oriented approach to pain management, which again is very different than what folks might find working with someone in the community or other prescribers who of course are making their own decisions with how they want to approach those kinds of medications.
Interesting. So, you know, here comes a patient like YM, right, that has found something that worked for her for the last 18 months. It sounds like, you know, any drug testing or anything they have done has not yielded, you know, results of her using other substances. But yet if she wants to, for the pain, your center to take over, she would have to agree to, I guess, titrate, not take the opioids anymore?
That is my understanding of how the clinic works, that we would not be continuing to prescribe medication at the same level or going up on that medication with the idea that we are trying to help patients not be on those medications long term. But again, I'll note that the ultimate decisions with that are certainly beyond my scope, and I have no say over how that goes.
Yeah, and this is also based on guidelines from the federal government and the laws that they're enacting, you know, related to the opioid epidemic. Is that correct?
That's
so
correct.
There's certain things that you can and can't do.
Right. And again, for me, there's nothing that I'm doing as it relates to whether a patient is on these medications or not. But anyway, I think that maybe I answered that question, so I'll shush.
And then can you talk a bit about the note, the progress note? Why was there an addendum after?
The addendum was in response to a secure message that was received by our team from YM requesting additional information to be included in the original note.
Okay.
Noting that that had taken place and added the addendum as a result of that.
Okay. Thank you. I have no further questions. Yes, Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little confused. I heard earlier that there was limited history when YM came to the appointment. And I'm hearing that the initial strategy of your team was to lower or eliminate opioids. Can you speak to that a little bit? So did Did you review a case file or some kind of history prior to YM coming for her appointment?
So, yes. And also, I feel like the decision about whether or not someone is going to end up being prescribed that medication is falling with the medical team member in that appointment. So I am not going in with an agenda in terms of we have to get this person off of this medication. It's supporting the medical team and the medical team's decision in that particular appointment based on patient's case history and other variables like Ms. Stark was mentioning, is that we're not going to be starting someone back up on an opioid-based medication, even if they've been on it for a long time in the past. And you can imagine this can lead to a lot of difficult conversations with patients about what it would look like to work with our team, which again is why ultimately it's a choice whether the individual wants to continue and move forward with that care.
And Dr. Simon, you may have been responding to something I said about not having a robust history. And yeah. I think I was talking more about maybe personal social history versus a medication regimen history of like the tramadol and how long the patient had been prescribed that versus some of the factors that I think were present that may have caused some discomfort that were not known previously, if that makes sense.
I think so. Thank you for that. Dr. Minter, so were your comments to YM and the analogies you used, were those comments after the medical team was talking about either lowering or eliminating the medications for YM?
I don't recall whether that was part of that conversation or if that was after that part. Those are things that we're typically weaving in throughout an appointment. Because our goal, again, is to really try and help provide some additional education about pain and the complexity of it, because we know that if we only approach pain from a biomedical lens, that typically we're not shifting the trajectory for folks long term.
Thank you.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. I appreciate Dr. Seidman's line of questioning on this for sure. Dr. Minnett, you have a physiatrist on that team, a physical medicine specialist physiatrist.
We have physiatrists who work at our Midtown clinic. And then at VA, pain treatment is split up into really three different departments. So there's the Chronic Pain Wellness Center, which is where I work. There's, of course, orthopedics. And then there's also a physical medicine and rehab clinic at the VA. So there are really three different places where folks might access pain management services.
So, and you may not be able to answer this question.
Okay.
Do your physiatrists adhere to the same policies of opioid management as what I'm hearing from your section of the treatment?
Yeah, I don't want to speculate about what those other prescribers are doing. What I can tell you is that my experience working with these physiatrists is they're typically working and assessing more for things like injections and ablations and other kinds of procedures that folks would be seeking for pain.
I think in terms of, it'd only be an editorial comment, but. You know, certainly the opioid epidemic and the high death rates and the fentanyl catastrophe in the United States, I think, has all gone into making providers gun shy, you know, in terms of discussing or treatment plans. I've worked with physiatry for quite a while. In connection with our VA here at Fort Whipple and also other places. And there's certainly seems to be a path available to people who are being managed in an opiate regime to continue that. But it's just, you know, it's unfortunate that there can't be. I think prescribers are just gun shy, and I'll just end my editorial comment. It's not a question. You don't need to respond. I'm just putting that out there. Thank you. I have no further questions, Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Dr. Seward. Okay. So the committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, respondents, attorneys representing the respondents, or any other individuals. Since I was the lead, I will start deliberations. You know, I think this is rather an unfortunate situation that, you know, it sounds like Dr. Minter was just following what is typically done at the clinic, but I think with this particular client, right, YM, perhaps knowing some of the nuances of this case. In general, I do not see necessarily anything that would rise to a violation at this point, but you know, I'm open to hearing what other people have to say. Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree, Dr. Medina. I don't see any act of unprofessional conduct. However, it does appear that it was there's really an unfortunate process issue, if you will, in terms of how perhaps the provider was perceived and came across. And that is truly unfortunate and makes me kind of sad, too. So those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. Dr. Seward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I absolutely agree with Dr. Seidman and also Dr. Medina. I'm not in looking through the code of ethics and looking through professional responsibilities and I'm not seeing anything that rises to a level of malpractice. I think it's exceptionally unfortunate that YM got caught up in that situation. I applaud her, you know, for coming forth and making these statements. I think this is how we can change things. And I think YM has been instrumental because I do believe that Dr. Menard is truly sensitive to this and that he may indeed take it back to his team in terms of reapproach for other people. If the chair would entertain a motion, I move that the case be dismissed.
I will second that motion. Any other comments? Dr. Seidman, did you have another?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Dr. Stewart, for those comments. I would even encourage Dr. Minter to take those this experience back to his team to kind of just debrief, if you will, this interaction to ensure that consumers are, you know, feel good about their interactions. So thank you for that.
And I will add to Dr. Seidman's comment. I think people in general need to be educated in that if they're being referred to your center, the goal is going to be to that the center's goal is to move them away from opiates so that they can make a decision on whether that is the direction they want to go or not. It is human nature, you know, if I have spent a long time, maybe even years, finding something that will work to manage my pain. And I finally find something and it has worked for me. It is working for me. And for the past 18 months, it's been working for me. I hope you can see how it comes across when someone then comes and says, yeah, we're going to move away from that. And it is, you know, to a certain extent, even a little demeaning of the patient's experience. And so I do understand there are some procedures, and I think you probably follow what you do day in and day out. I don't think there was anything done that was with malice or out of the ordinary for you. But I think it, even if it's just a procedure, I think it, really looking at it and thinking, how can our patients, the people that come here, perceive that? And perhaps it's not that your message, you know, was wrong. Perhaps it was ill-timed, right? Because if it's the first time someone comes into that clinic, you know, you don't know me, you don't know what I've been through, right? Why is this conversation, you know, from something that is working for me turning into something that wants to be changed at this point? So there is a motion and a second. So all in favor, please say aye.
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 Okay. Anyone opposed? The motion carries. So complaint number 25-10 regarding Dr. Minchard has been dismissed. The licensee and complainant will be notified in writing by board and by board staff in the near future regarding the committee's decision today. And we will take a break before we go into the next case. So let's take an 8-minute comfort break and let's come back at 9:50 for the next case.
So I can leave. I'm sorry. So I can leave.
Yes. Yes, YM. We're all done. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, YM. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And good luck.
Thank you.
So we're just waiting for, there he is. Okay. Dr. Stewart is back. Okay. So it is 9:51. We will resume the meeting now. The next complaint scheduled for review today is case number 25-11 against Judy Rand. Dr. Seidman, would you please provide a brief overview of this complaint as the lead?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is complaint number 25-11. Dr. Rand, license number 4022. Dr. Rand was issued her license by the board in 2009. She currently maintains a private practice. Dr. Rand provided individual counseling to the complainant for approximately 18 months, and services were billed to an insurance company and an HSA account for the complainant. In July of 2024, Dr. Rand reviewed a report from the billing company and discovered that the complainant had been overcharged several thousand dollars for the psychotherapy that was provided. Dr. Rand attempted to reach out to the complainant to discuss the issue, which was finally discussed at a psychotherapy session on July 19th of 2024. And that was the last session that occurred as the complainant terminated services. In August of 2024, the complainant sent a letter to Dr. Rand formally requesting a copy of her medical record. Later that month, Dr. Rand sent an initial reimbursement check to the complainant, which was a little bit less than was eventually agreed upon for reimbursement. On August 22nd of 2024, the complainant filed a complaint with the board alleging Dr. Rand had overcharged for approximately $7,700. Also charged that Dr. Rand inappropriately blamed the complainant for the billing issue. The complaint also alleges that during the final session, Dr. Rand made some inappropriate comments and had a prayer session with the complainant, which caused harm to the complainant.
The complaint also alleges that the records were not promptly provided. On October 28th of 2024, Dr. Rand notified the complainant that she was offering to pay an additional amount of money for reimbursement, and sent a second check in November with the total amount as agreed upon. The medical record was delivered to the complainant's home in October that appeared to have some damage to it, and there are some pictures to note that. In response, Dr. Rand provided a huge amount of exhibits for us to review and responded to those complaints, and really summarizes the whole complaint as a billing issue that could have been resolved easy. And that's the conclusion of my summary.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. Is complainant RP present? If so, please unmute yourself and state your initials only for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement. RP. So I see that RP is in the waiting. It's in the audience. You may unmute yourself.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead. You may make a statement.
Okay. As stated by the previous speaker, I was overbilled in 2023 and 2024, and it was around $8,000. This was brought to my attention by Dr. Rand, and I did eventually receive full payment as agreed several months after my last appointment. I had also verbally asked her for a copy of my records. Subsequently, she did send me a release, which I mailed to her twice. She said that she didn't receive the first one. She said that the second one was blank. The third attempt, I ended up having to send certified with signature, which took which was not picked up by her right away, but was eventually picked up by her or someone at a post office. But anyway, as outlined in my original complaint, which you all have a copy of, are the details of my last appointment with Judith Rand. And I'm not going to go into those details here or the stuff that led up to that last session, but they weren't. I wasn't handled in an appropriate way by Dr. Rand. Her demeanor and attitude, her actions. At one point, she dropped a large stack of records on the floor while she was speaking to me, and that was harmful to me. In regards to the prayer, I don't have a problem with prayer. That wasn't our normal practice. And the perpetrator, without going into any detail in my life, was a pastor. And so I feel that on this day, the prayer, having a prayer, and what she said during the prayer caused me a lot of uncertainty and stress and harm. And actually, the rest of that session to me felt like a deer in the headlights. I drove home after the session, and I think the shock started to set in on the drive home. And it became more and more difficult for me to drive. By the time I got home, I melted down, and I could not ever see her again as my therapist. And I called her office, or I texted and said that and confirmed in a second text to her. Her behavior as a trusted licensed therapist has since added to existing trust issues.
anxiety, self-esteem, and other symptoms that I already had, and as she was well aware of. It took months for me to even get the nerve to try to find another therapist because of the trust in what happened with her, and I've had to start all over with someone else, and obviously that's a cost to me, but it's also just hard to trust again. Again, the same day that I saw Judith Rand, I requested a copy of my records be made available to me. I was under the understanding that HIPAA requires my records to be provided to me within a set period of time. And my last session with Dr. Rand was on July 19th. The second batch of my records were received by me on October 13th. Judith Rand knew my weaknesses, and I believe she exploited them around this issue. I had not given permission to have her give out my personal records to anyone, much less an attorney. And out of the blue, I learned that she had gotten an attorney because I started getting emails in my personal email from an attorney who was asking me questions. I didn't even know this person. All of my records, not simply billing records, were given to this stranger, or worse, were given to some admin or intern. But anyway, someone made a copy of my records. Again, I never gave authorization for personal private information to be given out, and there was no court order to do so either. Out of the blue, I received a box one day in a regular shipping box, sealed and sent to me, signature required. I opened the box, and inside were a thick stack of my records. I thought that they were complete. I did not read through them at the time because receiving them just was a very hard thing to do because they came from someone I didn't know. Then out of the blue, I want to say it was like 10 days later, I go to my mailbox and there's a regular paper business envelope that was clearly overstuffed because it had ripped at the seams and the contents were spilling out into the mailbox. So obviously, this happened during transit, and it was found in the community mailbox, and it was like it was not even in the envelope anymore. And the second envelope contained very salacious materials, very personal, intimate information that I shared with Judith Rand. And I understand that she's allowed to give information to attorneys to prepare her defense, but not intimate knowledge, progress notes, diagnosis, intake forms, assessments, personal texts to and from family members that she had copies of, written letters from my family members with intimate details of my life. She gave, again, my personal email address to a stranger, a male one. She had to know that this would be very upsetting to me, knowing that male authority figures are the ones that caused me the damage that I described to you in the letter, and I don't want to talk about that here. But I believe there's many issues. Yes, it started with her letting me know that that I'd overpaid her or she'd overbilled me, whatever, about $8,000. So not just several thousand dollars. It was $8,000. And I believe that there were HIPAA violations. And I think that Judith Rand needs to be held accountable for each one. And this is not simply about the thousands of dollars that I was overbilled in 2023. That was never discovered in 2023 and in 2024 again. This is about trust, ethics, and how the practices of Judith Rand have affected me and other patients, their billing records, and their personal records.
Thank you for your statement, RP, and thank you for being here. Yes. Committee members, are there any questions for RP? Okay. Yes, Dr. Seven.
Thank you, Madam Chair. RP, thank you for being here today and sharing your experiences with us. RP, was faith-based counseling part of your treatment plan?
We talked about God. We talked about my faith, the obstacles of my faith. Prayer was not part of our session. And I'd say there was faith involved, but whether it was faith-based, I've had faith, strictly faith-based before, and I think this went beyond that. It wasn't always a topic.
Sure. Had you requested to have that faith-based or prayer as part of your work with Dr. Rand?
I did not request prayer, and then it was our first session when we talked about, did I want this to include any discussion of religion? I was open to that, and especially because the perpetrator, my father, was a pastor, I figured that would come up, so I did not object to it.
Yeah, and was that made clear to you that that would be part of the intervention for your particular treatment goals?
Well, it simply was. It wasn't a statement that she said to me, nor was the prayer.
No, it just happened.
Nor was prayer.
What is your pretty hair?
Excuse me?
I just asked, are you saying it just happened, or were you informed that that's how she worked?
It was an option in our first session, whether I wanted it to be or not, but I was very comfortable. And in fact, I wanted that to be, I knew that I would have to talk about that. So I was open to that.
Okay,
prayer
thank
was
you.
Not is a requirement.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Simon. Any other questions for RP? Okay. Okay. Dr. Rand, are you and your attorney present? If so, you may unmute both yourselves and say your full names for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Good morning. I'm Andrew Turk. I'm the attorney for Dr. Rand. She is here with me. She's off screen, but she's right next to me. Thank you, doctors, directors, Ms. Galvin, for this opportunity to address the board. There's a number of different issues, so I'm going to kind of run through them quickly, knowing that you'll ask questions if you have them. On the billing issue, I think even the complainant this morning has recognized that there was no intentional overbilling, despite the allegations of fraud in the initial complaint. That was brought to the complainant's attention by Dr. Rand. She did mail a substantial payment to the complainant before the board process had even begun. The problem there was that she'd asked the complainant to help her with the process and do a review of her own records, and she refused to do that. The amount that the complainant asked for changed over time. That's something that's pointed out in the response and in my separate communications with Director Michelson. The complainant refused to deal with me on the issue, but we did get it resolved. There was a settlement reached and signed by Dr. Rand and the complainant. And so as far as the actual putting aside the process of billing, the actual billing complaint, as far as the amount of money that was undeniably owed to the complainant, that has been resolved. As you heard, the complainant is the one who made the decision to terminate Dr. Rand's her treatment with Dr. Rand. Dr. Rand was not given a chance to effectuate a smooth transition. Dr. Rand offered to work with a new provider, and you just heard the complainant indicate that it was several months before she even looked for one. The lack of a smooth transition is not something that we believe can be laid at the feet of Dr. Rand, because regardless of how acrimonious or not the final session would have been, that would have been something that Dr. Rand was always prepared to do. She wasn't given the opportunity to do that. As far as prayer, Dr. Seideman, to respond to your specific question that you asked, on page 6 of the letter, and I realized that we provided you a lot of exhibits, but part of that is because we were asked to provide a complete copy of the chart for this patient. The very first form that she asked, and it's at RAND TX000007. The complainant, as you heard, did request Bible-based counseling. At the last session, Dr. Rand did specifically ask for permission to say a prayer, signaling that she believed it would be helpful to the parties given what they were going to talk about. There was really no way, given the breadth of the record relating to the importance of prayer to this particular individual, there was no way that Dr. Rand was going to understand that saying a prayer in that circumstance to help them work on a difficult thing was going to be negatively impactful for this patient. And again, starting at page 6, the letter cites to just a few of the many, many, many examples in the chart where the patient talked about prayer as being really central to her life and her life with her husband. As far as the alleged HIPAA violations go, I don't believe I need to tell the board members, but I want to go on the record that it is not a HIPAA violation for a clinician who is the subject of a complaint to provide records to their attorney. And that is all the records. And in fact, the board asked for a complete copy of the records, and as a result, it was incumbent upon me as a professional in the representation of Dr. Rand to review those records. So that is not a valid basis for a complaint. And if the board was to go back and look at some of the emails that followed after the initial complaint, if my memory serves me right, complainant also complained about the fact that the board had been provided copies of the records. Really, on that issue, it seems like the complainant hasn't really reviewed HIPAA and is using that as without knowledge of what it really means or what HIPAA says. There was a slight delay in getting the records. Complainant described some of the reasons as there was issues with the release. Then the complaint was filed. At that point, Dr. Rand believed it was better to have counsel deal with that issue, and so there was a delay there as we got the records, got them Bates labeled. The initial delivery of documents, I did reach out to Ms. Rand on a number of different issues, a number of different times via email, respectful emails. Dr. Michelson, or Director Michelson, has copies of those emails, and I don't know whether they've been made available to the board or not. Attempting to work with the complainant. We had offered, because we knew that she had issues with men, and we'd offered to have a female member of my staff deliver the documents by hand to her. She never responded to that request. She specifically asked that they be provided by mail. The first batch of documents, I put in two envelopes. I marked each envelope with her name and address on it and took them to UPS and had UPS deliver them in a box. So to be clear, the UPS people never saw the actual records. All they saw was two envelopes. And we did a return requiring a signature. The second batch of documents, which she has accused us of withholding purposely, it was just a production issue. Dr. Rand's chart was divided into, I believe, 7 different subsets. And as I was reviewing the records, I realized there was a gap. And I don't remember if one set had been marked mismarked as a number or whether we just hadn't gotten it, but it was a much smaller subset of documents. They were not overstuffed into an envelope. It is unfortunate that the envelope got torn, but I send records of all different kinds via envelope, via mail, all the time without that happening. So it just is a bizarre event. I don't blame, nor does Dr. Rand blame the complainant for being upset that that happened, but it certainly wasn't intentional and it wasn't a violation of HIPAA to do that. I think that addresses pretty much everything. I would like to just underscore for the board that Dr. Rand did not select me in an attempt as her counsel in an attempt to trigger the complainant. It was never my intent to trigger the complainant. I did not call her. My first email to her explained who I was and what I was doing. I believe I copied Director Michelson on that email. She was definitely copied on other ones, so there was no attempt to do anything kind of in the dark or to cause additional harm to complainant. But as Dr. Seideman said in his review, this really is a billing complaint that has been escalated to a board complaint. Dr. Rand was at all times willing to work this out with the complainant. She tried to do that immediately upon finding out about the billing error. She tried to do it before the final session, and the complainant didn't do that. It's unfortunate that we're here, but we don't believe that there's any basis for further action by the board and request that the complaint be dismissed.
Do I have a chance to rebut some of what was...
No, RP, no, I'm sorry. This was their opportunity to make a statement. And now, committee members, are there any questions for Dr. Rand or her attorney, Mr. Turk? Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to hear from Dr. Rand.
On anything in particular, or...
No, just in terms of the complaint and her reaction to it.
Good morning. Hi, I'm Dr. Judith Rand. Yes, when I became aware through a report from my billing company that it appeared that the client had been overbilled, I took that very seriously. I called the billing people who were out of office at noon on Friday. They could not receive the information from me or my questions. So as soon as my business day was complete, I called the client, the complainant, RP, to inform her of my newfound awareness of this overcharge. And I had to leave her a voicemail message because she did not pick up her phone. I did ask her or tell her that I was aware that there is a possibility of an overcharge in what appeared to be in excess of $5,000. Did not have a firm number, but that I was very concerned and that I was offering her to call me on the weekend off business hours on my personal cell phone so that we might discuss the matter on the weekend and develop a plan to resolve the matter and not take up her sessions during the week doing that. So I never heard back from her the entire weekend, which shocked me. I did hear back. She made two phone calls or text messages to me on Monday morning finally. And her, in a paraphrase summary format, she said, I don't owe her any money. She is totally unaware of any money being owed and that I must be in error of some sort. And I wanted to, my feeling was I needed to impress upon her that this was a serious matter and that I wanted to resolve it quickly. Monday night, I believe it was Monday night, I was feeling very distressed. And I did not sleep well. I hardly slept at all. I take my business and my clients and their care that I'm entrusted with their care very seriously. And upon waking me Tuesday morning, knowing I hardly slept at night, I did not feel at full mental capacity to see clients all day long like I typically do. I canceled Tuesday's list of clients with the exception of the complainant. Contact her through two different methods to see if I could push back her session. I believe the appointment that Tuesday was, I believe it was 1 o'clock-ish, but what I was asking for is to meet her later in the afternoon so that I could get some rest and then fresh to talk with her about the matter. I got no response from her regarding my request to push the appointment back. I left one message with her husband, who happened to answer her cell phone, the number that I called. And in my opinion, he was condescending and calling me sweetie on the phone, and I didn't feel like I was the matter at hand was being taken seriously enough, so I simply repeated that I would like to talk to the complainant herself. I never got the opportunity to meet with her. She never responded about the appointment being pushed back on Tuesday, so the next time I did see her would be her second appointment for that week, which was Friday at, I don't remember the hour, but it would have been that Friday the 19th, if I'm not mistaken. It was the 19th, yeah. So my impression was that, and my professional opinion was that she was in some type of denial about the actual facts of the matter, and that she trusted me, that I was telling her something that was in my mind truthful, but that she did not believe it. She had no evidence of it, and so when she came in Friday, I was expecting someone, who was grateful. I was expecting a client who might be grateful that I was the one who called it to her attention, and that she would be amicable in working things out about how we go forward with this billing matter. I was slowly surprised. It seemed, in my opinion, it seemed that there was some animosity coming from her towards me. I did not verify it at the beginning. I simply asked her, if you will allow me, on page 6 of the investigative report, page 8 of the investigative report, under RP's final session, bullet point 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, bullet point 5, Dr. Rand explained that the issue at hand might be uncomfortable or awkward. She wanted to begin the discussion by establishing the party's best of intentions as fellow Christians. We had conversed almost every session about God, prayer, the Bible, and how important her spiritual life had become to her, and how grateful she was that we were including God in any session that she chose, which was almost all sessions. References to those religious matters can be found in the therapy notes that I took during sessions. In the investigative report, I believe on page 3, she has somewhat different recollection than mine on page 8. If you look at bullet point 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, bullet point 9, Dr. Rand proceeded, this is RP's take, Dr. Rand proceeded to start the session with a prayer, asking God to help us through the session because the things we need to discuss were going to be difficult. I had called them uncomfortable and awkward, but I was prepared in that session. My desire was to establish that we had worked so well together across the 18 months worth of time that we could continue to do that, that this matter was a billing error and that it needed to be addressed. I would like to mention that the documents that I brought to the session were hers and her alone records, no one else's. And I brought those records with me in case there were questions that came up regarding any of the matters that I was raising with this client. So that was the purpose for bringing the records. In the interest of saving time, our sessions usually lasted up to 60 minutes. I was wanting to make sure we got as much accomplished that day as we could regarding this matter. So,
thank you, Dr. Rand. Stuart, I'm sorry. We need to continue moving along. Do you have any other questions for Dr. Rand?
No, Madam Chair, I do not. Thank you.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. Good morning, Mr. Turk and Dr. Rand. Dr. Rand, is this in your documents that you provided us, you mentioned that as part of your remediation process in terms of your practice, that you ran a couple audits, manual audit, you got some information from the insurance companies and you ran some manual audits. Is that the first time you've ever done an audit in your practice in terms of your billing practices and your financial processes?
No, in fact, up until recently, my husband had been my business director. So we sat down weekly with our billing person on every Tuesday at lunchtime. She would come to my office and we would go through the records of the billing process we were using, as well as outstanding debt and income owed.
Yeah, how come it took so long to catch this billing error? I'm really concerned because this is a huge amount.
Yes, and I was surprised. I had switched billing companies to Red House, a reputable billing company in the state of Arizona and across the United States. Many, many, many psychologists in Arizona use them. So I was using a reputable company. They had told me verbally on the phone when I hired them that they would answer all financial questions that I had and keep me informed as to any outstanding or what seemed to be out of the ordinary amount of debt. And I trusted them on that. So when I was reading their reports, the reports were confusing, and I called her a number of times to tell her I didn't understand something I had found in the report. I am not an accountant. I'm not numbers-based. That's not an area of expertise for me, so I needed much explanation. So I had called Red House many times. Lynn was my point of contact. And I asked her several times to keep me informed about these things. She did not. And I misunderstood what the number meant. Instead of, apparently the number had a parenthesis around it, and that has a special accounting meaning to it. And I took it as it was money that the client owed me and not money that I owed her. So my misunderstanding about that was a genuine mistake on my part. But when I did see it in that report that I documented in our response, I called her immediately. I called Lynn. And Lynn, their company is huge, and they have the United States as their territory. She was always brushing me off. She called me a minor company in her practice, but they had much, much bigger firms, and that she didn't really have patience or time for the number of questions that I had as a small business owner. The week that I found this overage, overbilling, I called her on a Friday, and I said, I need you to go through this record with me because I don't understand. And she said, yes, we will do that next week. So I called the following week, and she answered the phone, and she said, I'm on vacation this. I don't have time for this. I don't owe you this explanation now. You're just going to have to wait till I return. And I impressed upon her the urgency of this matter, that this number was excessive. And she refused to talk to me. When she did come back into town, I called her again and said, well, we need to discuss that. And she said because I was bugging her, she was terminating me as a client. So that was inappropriate, unprofessional conduct on the part of a billing company that I had hired. But I had no way of getting, of handling her and her, the issue she was presenting to me at that point. My concern was the client and the overcharge for this claim, complainant.
I have no other questions.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Seidman. I actually would like to make a motion to go into executive session as I have some questions for Ms. Gavin.
Second.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
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 Okay. None opposed. The motion carries. Okay, we are all back. So the committee will now begin deliberation. Please know that deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any other individuals. Dr. Seidman, would you please begin the deliberation since you are the lead?
Sure, Dr. Medina. Thank you. So, you know, in hearing from both the complainant and the respondent, I'm still kind of surprised by the huge amount of money that was overpaid and the lack of diligence on the part of the provider to stay on top of her practice's financial records. That's my main comment there. There may be more later, but.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Seidman. Yes, Dr. Stewart.
I certainly agree with Dr. Seidman that, you know, the amount of money and for it to go undetected that length of time. But apparently Dr. Rand was reliant upon the Red Book, Red House to do the financials, and it is a reputable firm. I mean, they present at all the conferences and things like that. Almost this seems to be the exception to the rule. It seems to be the, you know, the tail end of the Gaussian curve, of the bell-shaped curve. It seems to be the odd event. I guess I'm not seeing any deliberate ill intent anywhere.
Yeah, yes. I don't disagree with that. Sorry, I'm sorry, Dr. Medina.
Go ahead.
I don't disagree. I don't believe there was any volitional intent to harm. There has been harm. The consumer does not have money in her HSA to at that time to get additional services. So, volitional or not, and whether it's a I'm not saying the company's not reputable. But this particular instance, it did happen.
Yes. I was going to say, you know, often I think we as psychologists tend to be obviously more well-versed, right, in clinical matters, not so much in numbers or money matters. However, you know, the mistake that this company made, and the magnitude of it, how long it went for, it really doesn't speak very well about this company. It was a very easy mistake to catch. They were, you know, in essence, they were getting double paid for services, kind of, right? And they just continued to charge, which was not correct in this case. I mean, I do appreciate the fact that Dr. Rand, when she realized the mistake, fairly quickly informed the client and tried to resolve it. I do appreciate that. You know, I certainly, which is unfortunate, right? When we hire services such as a billing company or whatever services we hire, we trust that we are going to receive, you know, good service and accurate advice, and that our what we hired them for will be done correctly. I'm concerned that the length of time, right, that the records were not audited by Dr. Rand to still make, you know, to verify that things were correct. It's still surprising. I don't think there was any malice in what, you know, transpired. I do think when she caught the mistake, she reached out to RP and tried to then solve the matter. Dr. Rand offered to leave the credit. Of course, the client declined. And, you know, it's unfortunate that a solution wasn't found right away, or that this was have been able to be resolved sooner, in a sense. So are there any motions at this point? Yes, Dr. Stewart.
I move that the case be dismissed, Dr. Medina.
Okay. I second that motion. I don't think there was any malice. I do think that Dr. Ryan tried to remedy the situation in a somewhat expeditious manner. There were not, you know, necessarily always responses. When the records, the other aspect to it was the records release. I think that Dr. Rand, through her attorney, you know, at some points that were not getting responses, and that may have delayed the release of the records, but records were released and the debt owed, the overpayment was made to the complainant. So I second that motion as well. Yes, Dr. Seidman.
Yes, I agree with both of you here. I do want to strongly encourage Dr. Rand to continue with her audits, and I appreciate the changes you've made in your practice to ensure that this doesn't happen again, and to ensure that your consumers aren't harmed by your reliance on an outside provider who, quite frankly, didn't do their job.
Yep. Okay. So there is a second. I second Dr. Stewart motion we've discussed. Okay. So here, no further discussion. I will call for the vote. All in favor of the motion to dismiss the case, say aye.
Aye.
Okay. None opposed. Motion carries. Complaint number 25-11 regarding Dr. Rand has been dismissed. The licensee and complainant will be notified in writing by board staff in the near future regarding the committee's decision today. So moving on to the next case. The next complaint scheduled for review today is case number 25-07 against Kathleen Kramer. Dr. Stewart, would you please provide a brief overview of this complaint as the lead?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Medina. Kathleen Kramer, PhD, complaint number 25-07, was licensed in 2004 here in Arizona. The complainant, KB, is an attorney, and so the attorney asked for release of records, and Dr. Kramer refused to do that. Dr. Kramer apparently sent a letter to the court that had ordered the release, stating psychotherapist client privilege communications as her foundation to refuse to release the records. In Dr. Kramer's response to that, she cites the Code of Federal Regulations on psychotherapist client records. And I don't know if we need to go into executive session right now, but when this comes up, it maybe would be a good idea. And so I think Dr. Kramer continues to refuse to release the records.
Okay. And your summary is done?
No, that's it. I mean, that's
okay.
It's still
Okay.
So it's still hanging in the air.
Okay. Okay. I will give Dr. Kramer, I mean, I'm sorry, KB, the opportunity to speak, then Dr. Kramer, and then we can go into executive session, if you so wish. Okay, so is complainant KB present? If so, please unmute yourself and state your initials only for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement. Is KB present? Does not appear like KB is here. Okay, Dr. Kramer, I see that you are here. If so, you may unmute yourself and state your full name for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Okay, just to clarify, KB did not request my records. Judge Kushner did. It was a court order for medical health records directed to me. I immediately responded to Judge Kushner's letter indicating that I had psychotherapy notes, that they have a higher level of privilege and confidentiality than the rest of the medical record, and therefore I was not willing to release them because I needed to protect the confidentiality and privacy of my patient. I quoted two or three legal sources in my response to Judge Kushner. He then filed a minute entry indicating that the court had received my letter and had chosen to take no further action on the issue. So KB then filed a complaint against me, claiming that I refused to release my psychotherapy notes in violation of the court order. As stated in my response, that is inaccurate. The court never ordered release of my psychotherapy notes. It ordered release of medical health records or mental health records. I keep psychotherapy notes separate from the rest of the medical chart, and I have explained that in my response. Obviously, it's very stressful to receive a court order. I did extensive research before responding to Judge Kushner to make sure that my response was supported by legal and ethical guidelines. I complied with all HIPAA guidelines. I complied with APA ethical guidelines. I also complied with APA legal guidelines as set forth by the APA Committee on Legal Issues. That committee published its guidelines for responding to court orders in the Journal of Professional Psychology, Research and Practice, Volume 47, 2016. It is my understanding that since submitting my response to the board, the trial in this whole case was held back in November. The judge rendered his decision, and at no time during his decision-making process did he order production of my psychotherapy notes, nor did he find me in violation of his court order. So I believe I've conducted myself in a manner that protected my patient's confidentiality and privacy while also honoring legal and ethical guidelines. And I request that the complaint be dismissed.
Thank you, Dr. Kramer. Are there any questions for Dr. Kramer?
No.
Dr. Sura, I believe you wanted to go into executive session.
I move that we go into executive session for legal advice.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Okay. Okay. So the committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberations is a time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any other individuals. Dr. Stewart, would you please begin the deliberation since you are the lead?
Thank you, Dr. Medina. I think this is an argument that is between the psychologist and the court. I think the court's no action has not ordered Dr. Kramer to release the records, I think that's the resolution. I don't think that we need to be in the middle of that. I certainly do not want to pretend to tell a superior court what to do. You know, that's their decision.
Correct. And I agree with you, Dr. Stewart. Given these specific facts, I would say that the fact that the court took no action, that means they sided with Dr. Kramer if they wanted to have further information, just like psychotherapy notes, whatever release, they could have mandated her to do so. Okay, so is there a motion for this case? Yes, Dr. Stewart.
I move that the case be dismissed.
Second. Okay.
There is a motion and a second by Dr. Seidman. Any further discussion? Okay. Hearing no further discussion, I will call for the vote. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Okay. None opposed. Motion carries. Complaint number 25-15 regarding, 25-07 regarding Dr. Kramer has been dismissed. The licensee and complainant will be notified in writing by the board staff in the near future regarding the committee's decision today. Okay. We'll move on to the next case, but we will take a 5-minute break before we do so. So everybody, please come back at 11:05 and we'll start with our last case for today's meeting. Thank you. So we are back. we'll resume the meeting. It is 11:06. The next complaint scheduled for review today is case number 25-15 against Jody Cuneo. Dr. Seidman, would you please provide a brief overview of this complaint as the lead?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Cuneo holds a license number 4887, was initially licensed by the board in 2017. She's the sole owner and director of Grandis Health, which is an agency that provides pre-doctoral internship and postdoctoral supervised professional experiences for psychology trainees. From March of 2021 to August of 2022, Dr. Julie Curley completed her internship at Grandis Health under the primary supervision of Dr. Cuneo. And from an unknown date until July of 2024, Dr. Curley completed her postdoctoral professional experience under the supervision of Dr. Cuneo. And the start date has never been verified for that particular training experience. At its meeting on September 6th of 2024, the board reviewed Dr. Curley's request to withdraw her pending licensure application due to elements of her internship program under Dr. Cuneo's supervision, which failed to comply with statutory and rule requirements for licensure. The board approved Dr. Curley's withdrawal request and chose to open up a complaint against Dr. Cuneo for further investigation regarding various concerns relative to these training programs that she provides. Specifically, the complaint has to do with the following. The application review committee reviewed the exam and licensure application that Dr. Curley submitted and noticed that on the written training plan for the Grandis Health supervised professional experience, it noted that the compensation for Dr. Curley appeared to be for direct service hours only and not as a stipend as stipulated in AAC Rule 426-209C, which states specifically payment between a supervisor and supervisee. A supervising psychologist may pay a monetary stipend or fee to a supervisee if the amount paid by the supervisor is not based on the supervisee's productivity or revenue generated by the supervisee. The written training plan language specifically noted the intern will be compensated for the client contact hours only, and administrative and/or report writing times are not covered in this manner. It goes on to say, but should the intern make an arrangement to work on a sliding fee scale with the client, this rate will supersede the default rate. At the ARC's committee meeting on July 26th of 2024, Dr. Cuneo made some statements which include, trainee pay structure was not a standard flat stipend, but, quote, was going to vary by the amount of client contact hours. Timesheets were requested for Dr. Curley's internship program, and it appears that they were completed under Ben J. Bush AZ, who happens to be a psychologist who's licensed by this board as well. There was a number of difficulties with pay stubs. They weren't complete. There were a number of missing. And it appeared that when Dr. Curley was in front of the ARC, she noted she was paid for each hour she was with a client and that she was not compensated for the hours during which she was provided supervision. Dr. Curley also shared that other interns are afraid to speak up about this issue for fear of retaliation that may adversely affect their training experience. Related to Dr. Curley's application, Dr. Cuneo submitted 7 different iterations of the internship verification forms, which had varying start dates and end dates and number of hours. And in addition, on the forms, Dr. Cuneo answered yes to the question, quote, did the psychology training program have at least 2 psychologists on staff as supervisors? Ultimately, Dr. Curley's request for application for licensure was denied. However, she was approved to withdraw her application. In response, Dr. Cuneo provided a 4-page response and admitted saying that the wording in the training manual was unclear about how trainees were compensated. She also noted that she understands how the wording was terribly misleading and made the organization to appear exploitive. On September 13th of 2024, Walden University removed an intern that was receiving training under Dr. Cuneo's supervision. And there appears to be some question about a secondary supervisor. Is Dr. Bushman a contractor for Grandis Health, is an employee, is a secondary supervisor? Does he have access to records? So that's unclear. And that concludes my summary of this case.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. As this complaint was opened by the board, there is no complainant. Dr. Cuneo, are you present? If so, you may unmute herself and state your full name for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Yes, good morning, everyone. I would like to thank you for allowing this time to clarify. I understand that this was due to, sorry, I'm looking down at my statement to make sure I hit everything. This was due to the initial complaint brought subsequent to an internship application. There were alterations made to the company internship training manual. As I had asked during a past meeting, what did the board think would help to clarify our wording so that we could show that we were not paying on a client contact based level. So those alterations had been made. I just wanted to make sure that the interns that it was clear that the interns were being treated correctly, that they received the proper training, that they received the amount of proper training, and that they received credit for all of their time. Just to note, there have not been any interns as of the date of complaint when Walden had removed a student from his internship. And I have not had contact with any interns. Some of them have contacted me. They wanted to know what was going on. I told them that I believed it was not in best interest to contact with anyone until after everything was settled with the board, so that there was not any undue influence. I think it's been a matter of, or it will be a matter of providing information to the board to confirm that things have been done correctly with the interns, and that I just want to coordinate with the board to make sure that the interns who have hours already are allowed to license. And of note, I'm not sure statements that have been received from interns at all, but I had heard that the intern who was pulled from the site, I'm going to say about three quarters of the way through his internship, was allowed to retain his hours while he was at my facility.
Okay. Committee members, are there any questions for Dr. Acuna? And I actually do have questions, so I'm going to go ahead and start. Dr. Acuna, what is a stipend? What's the definition of a stipend?
Stipend, as far as I'm aware, is going to be an amount that is paid that is a set amount, I think, is part of the definition, so that it is not dependent upon production or billing received or anything like that with our offices. We did have a varying stipend. This was discussed at one of the previous meetings to allow interns to have part-time hours if need be, which we did do sometimes, or to go to full-time hours.
Okay. And so if they were part-time, how did they submit their hours? How many hours did they submit? What was their payment?
The hours were tracked through Meditrack, which we learned during just this one application process. I have not had a problem before or after this with Meditrack and with what was submitted to the school. There were also, before the end of the quarter, as we were going along, it was the interns keeping track of their hours, which I think is what led to some of the discrepancies in the one application.
So what hours were they paid for? I understand it's from what they tracked. So out of the hours that they tracked, what hours were they paid for?
That would be for the ratio of using how many hours they would see someone to how many hours were needed for supervision. And we just used that as a ratio there. There was not a absolute, you did 20 hours this week and we needed an hour and a half of supervision or something like that. It was done in a ratio basis. So that was not actually tied to the hours as far as I was tracking.
So it was not tied to direct hours, to hours that they were logging in as direct hours with clients?
No, it was not, because it did not cover anything that would have been meeting times with clients, as we were largely forensic practice. So we would have outside hours that included contact hours for, I'm trying to think of specific cases, anything that would have been related to the client and having, say, a lawyer present, or if there was a case that was an IEP or something like that, or the report writing, which I believe some of the schools had counted as part of the direct hours, but those were not counted.
So what you're saying is they were not paid for those hours?
They were not paid directly related to the amount of time that was spent specifically with each client. That, I believe, can also be shown in my therapy notes for the varying session times. You know, if someone had a half hour session or a half hour session with the client and then however long to do their notes after, or a 45 minute session with the client. And so that was not related to that either, which would have been the client, direct client hours.
Just to bring up to your attention, every single amount that was paid, the only records that we have of payment align with $65 per hour. Every single amount I can divide by 65 and get either a 2, a 3, a 4, whatever that is in that sheet of payment that you submitted.
Okay. And that is possible. But again, the sessions, because they would not have made an exact hour, it would not have been related to how we did insurance billing. And I believe this is then related to the definition of client contact hours that was used by the schools. And so, as I said, I'm just trying to hopefully show that everyone was.
So let me ask you this another way. If there's a week in which an intern did not see a single client or patient, but worked on other things related to a case, mm-hmm. would they receive payment for that week, including
supervision? For that week.
Okay. So that is based on direct hours. Okay. Thank you. I do have another question. Where did you complete your internship, Dr. Cuneo?
My internship?
Yep.
That was actually with Dr. Bushman as my primary supervisor and Dr. Jill Plavel. And I did a similar setup to what I've had going with a couple of interns now, where you had the primary intern, the primary supervisor, and it was in one office. And then you just had the secondary in case you needed it.
Okay. Is Dr. Bushman part of your practice?
No, he is not part of Grandis Health. That is why there was the conflicting information and the need for clarification, which makes sense to me. He has never been contracted with Grandis Health. The contracts for when we were primary or secondary supervisors would have been contracts with the school, and that was the technicality there that I had put down.
Would a secondary supervisor have access to records from your practice then?
Yes, they would. We had to very specifically write that up through the school to make sure, because it was not an electronic health record system that he is using at all, so that it was that he would have to have access to somebody's records. And we used my records so that they weren't using just paper records at the other system. Mm-hmm. It was simply because I had the electronic health records. And so he was granted access into my electronic health records, specifically only for access to records to any interns if he needed them. But I'm unsure actually whether he has actually ever been in there to do that.
Okay. So how do you attest 7 times that he is on staff? The question is very specific on the application. Do you have a second psychologist on staff providing supervision? And every time the question was answered, yes, by you.
Because we clarified with the school that it was going to be almost a training consortium. They did not use the term consortium, but that it was, that's how it was going to qualify. Because he does not work out of my Phoenix office. We have shared office space in the past, back and forth. If someone needs an office space in a different town, then we have done that, but we are not in practice together. But we did clarify with the school to make sure that they knew that we were two separate entities who'd be working together to work with the interns in case a secondary supervisor was needed. Or in one case, for one of the interns, that I would have been a secondary supervisor, but was at a separate location.
So when you start providing the internship, right, how did you set it up? What did you look into? How did you determine that you could do that?
Are we speaking about like when I first, like the, with the first intern and the, okay. I had the school contact me, Walden University actually, because someone was looking for a secondary supervisor and they saw that I was listed as practicing in Phoenix and in Tucson. And we went through and I believe there may have been a training through the university, although this would have been approximately five, sorry, I'm looking at my notes, approximately 5 to 6 years ago, but I believe there may have been a short self-guided training thing. This is what we would expect and this is what you need, that sort of thing.
Okay, so that was a secondary. How did you decide to go ahead and be the primary supervisor and primary placement for an intern?
I can look at my dates, but I believe it's after I had worked with someone for almost a year and had been a licensed psychologist for several years that I said that we could pick up the Meditrack, that they could end up working in the Phoenix office and that it would feel comfortable there supervising.
So what in general did you look at our roles as statutes at what's required for an internship?
Yes, honestly, I started with my own and then went through, in addition to the universities, there was another agency that I had had access to their training manual. I had not been associated with them, but I knew someone who was associated with them. So I went through and checked their training manual because I wanted to make sure that I was going to be able to provide first enough hours. That was my initial concern, was that I would have enough hours and that if an intern was simply following me through a case, sitting in on sessions with me or sitting in on desensitization sessions out in the field, that we would have everything counted and what needed to be done to make sure that the interns got all of the hours that were, they were getting credit for the right amount of hours and that things were being documented the right way. And again, Meditrack helped tremendously with that yeah. program.
Did you look at any of the other many internship placements that are in the state?
I am not sure that I specifically officially looked at other placements in the state. Again, this the access that I had to another training manual was due to someone's colleague who had their training manual from with their placement.
Well, and the reason why I asked, Dr. Cuneo, I started a training program from scratch, from zero. One of the first things that I did was look at all the other internship placements in the state, and where I went to look for that was the APIC directory, which has probably over 15 sites, between 10 and 20 sites in the state of Arizona. Their handbooks, their brochures are listed there. Did you do any of that research in order to look at, okay, this is what is being offered, this is, you know, how things tend to be structured?
I did not go through the specific APIC site, but I had gone through and was talking to various psychologists who had been supervisors or who were supervisors at the time and was using them for guidance. And as I mentioned, I had definitely two manuals that my manual ended up being a conglomeration of. If not, it may have been three, but there were definitely two that I pulled from to make sure and understood. It wasn't just that I just reiterated information back into a training manual so that I was, at the time, believed that there was not going to be any problems and that I would be able to provide the supervision needed.
Yes. I mean, and the question here is not just the supervision, that is one aspect, but it's the stipend piece. And all the manuals on the APIC directory, every single one, every single brochure will have a stipend listed. None of them will have a pay per direct contact, per direct hours, not a variable amount paid. And even if an intern has zero direct contact with a client during a week, it doesn't matter because it is a stipend in every single site, regardless of their accreditation. Not all of them are APA accredited, will have a stipend. I'm just so surprised, because even when you look at the ASPA consortium, when they used to offer internships, they no longer do that. It is a stipend. It was a stipend. And so it is truthfully very surprising to me that this pay structure was adopted. I don't have any further questions. Dr. Seidman, you may proceed.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. Dr. Caneo, thanks for being here today. I have multiple questions for you, and it's probably not surprising. What's your education, training, and experience in doing clinical supervision?
When I was in a master's program, right after I had finished this master's program, I'd stayed on to work with the, actually it was a staff psychologist, and was providing supervision through 2 to 3 different universities at the time, but was providing it to master's level interns. And that was just cognitive behavioral therapy.
Was that as a site supervisor or a practicum seminar instructor?
That was as a site supervisor. And that okay. would have been me, that would have been as part of my job description at the time.
And you were supervised on that, doing that supervision?
Yes, I was. Yes.
And what's your education, training, and experience related to pre-doctoral and post-doctoral clinical supervision?
This would be during my pre-doctoral and then post-doctoral internship time. There was encouragement of working with the newer interns. This would have also been a supervised time, and getting everyone on board with early case management and things like that.
I'm not really clear on that. I don't understand what that is.
That they would have been when I was with, like during my internship, providing, yeah. I did approximately 18 months. I know I definitely went over a year. I think I did 6 quarters. And during, I'm going to say possibly about halfway through, was helping to provide supervision, under supervision of a licensed psychologist, and provide some case management.
And who were those people? Who are the trainees?
That would have been like other interns at the site. I would have to go through and come up with names if you would like names, but I could.
You were clinically supervising your peers?
We were doing like case management and it wasn't an official. There was nothing that was written there. Let me clarify that. Also, this was not a, something that they could have counted as their clinical supervision time. It was just what we were, I don't want to say the older interns, but the older interns helping the newer interns.
So that's peer supervision. That's not clinical supervision.
Yeah, okay. Yes, peer supervision.
Let me ask you, have you ever had a class in clinical supervision?
It was actually quite a while ago. It was during my master's program, and that would have been for supervising other master's level, to be honest. It would have just
not for psychology. Not for psychologists.
Not for psychologists, no.
Okay. Thank you for that. I'm not done yet, so please just bear with me, okay? Why did it take so many iterations of Dr. Curley's verification forms for her to have to submit again and again and again and again?
I think I had mentioned once in there, actually, I'm going to go back on this sentence. It was tracked through Dr. Curley tracking her own hours, and my saying, you know, did these match up with Meditrek, and how does everything look, and you know, and not going through honestly on a fine tooth comb for her application process when she did it. And then we noticed one time that Meditrek cut out, I believe it was an entire quarter of hours for her. So there was one of the applications to another, there was a very significant change in the amount of hours because what I believe happened is that she went through, she looked at the hours reported by Meditrex, she put it on her application, and then it was noticed later that those numbers were significantly lower than what they should have been. So we went back in, but that would have only accounted for one of those times. The others were, I believe there were typos on when intern dates started that didn't match up with what I had in my office. And I believe that a lot of typos that went through for when did internships start and stop, and what was in according to when our Grandis Health Supervision Training Manual was signed versus when things were submitted to the school versus actual start dates. And I think that's what threw off hours on hers.
Well, her postdoc is unrelated to Walden University, by the way.
Yes.
Only her pre-doctoral internships affiliated with Walden University, yes. Right?
Yes.
Okay. Did you keep supervision notes when you do supervision with your pre-doctoral and postdoctoral trainees?
Yes. Yes.
And do they have dates on those?
They do. I could provide the dates that those happened. We did. That was not on a scheduled event. It was not like every Friday at 11 o'clock or something like that. It was as schedules allowed, but we would make sure that hours were provided. If it looked like someone was going to be low for hours that week, there were some weeks that we provided them at odd times just to make sure.
So are you saying that you were doing contemporaneous supervision? Is that what you're describing?
Yes. Yes. During the, yes. Yeah.
Okay. I have one other question for you. So help me understand Dr. Bushman's relationship with Grandis Health. He was a contracted supervisor through Walden?
Yes.
So how does he supervise postdocs then?
I did not have a contract with him. I had contracts with Walden. Again, that Dr. Bushman was not associated with Grandis Health. And any contracts would have been through the university, as you know, we are two separate entities and we are providing.
In order to have access to records, he has to have an agreement with you.
Yes. So we did that. And that was actually, paperwork was facilitated by the university. And what I did was just went through and gave him, that's how it was documented. And then I went through and he was given access. I can show if someone needs, as an administrator, specifically as a supervisor, to only those interns and only those patient records that would have been related to those interns.
And were those patients notified that there was a secondary supervisor that had access to their records?
Yes, they would have been on the paperwork. And again, I'm not sure, that would be a question for him, but I am unaware of any time when he would have actually gone into the system.
But he was seeing Grandis Health patients. He was supervising Grandis Health patients.
He would have, I'm not sure that he ever did go in and see any of those. Was he listed as a secondary supervisor? Yes. And did he have access to it? But I do not believe that he ever actually went in and did any case management or had any clinical supervision time, most specifically here with Dr. Curley.
Madam Chair, I don't have any other questions.
Yes, Dr. Stewart. Thank you, Dr. Seidman. Dr. Stewart, you may proceed.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. Dr. Seidman, thank you so much. That was most insightful, I think. What if I may ask, you say that Dr. Bushman supervise postdoctoral students, is that correct? Postdoctoral interns?
I believe that he is listed on Dr. Curley's application for a postdoctoral, but generally, no, he and I are not working together on that. That would be...
And he's employed by whom?
He is self-employed. He has his own practice.
And what is his connection with Walden University? Do you know that?
I know that he had been contracted with them to provide clinical supervision to interns.
Postdoctoral interns?
That I would not be aware. I'm actually not involved in his business at all, so I'm not sure what his business dealings would be related to that.
Once a student graduates, Dr. Stewart, then it's no longer, the university is no longer involved in that. I believe Ms. Gavin has a comment.
I would yield to Dr. Seidman first. I believe he had his hand up.
I was going to clarify what Dr. Medina said. So once a person graduates and does a postdoctoral experience, there's no university affiliated anymore. They're done with the university.
Okay. So my question, is to Dr. Quignon. In the beginning of your testimony, you stated that you once had an intern affiliated with Walden. Walden pulled him. And I understood you to say that the hours he had with you, he was allowed to use towards licensure. Is that what you said?
Again, I've tried to limit contact. I have had some interns reach out to me and I've tried to limit contact. That would actually be inferred. So I should clarify that. I was asked to provide a letter of recommendation for him to move forward to a postdoc opportunity. And there is no way that he would have been able to do that if he needed to restart his internship hours. And that's why, sorry, I am going to use the word assumed here. I assumed that they allowed him to do that because that the university had counted his hours, not that licensing had allowed him for hours, but that a university had.
Okay, I think I just want to be very clear because I heard that you had, suggested that those hours were permitted for licensure. And in fact, that did not happen. And I want anyone listening to this recording, attending this meeting, reading the minutes to be absolutely comfortable in knowing that those hours, that application has not been presented to the board. And if there was a stipend involved, like with applicant Curley, it would be safe to assume that those hours will not count. So I'm just cautioning you in making any inferences or assumptions about what has occurred on the licensing end.
Yes, sorry. That would have been an error in speech on my end. I had only heard that it appeared that the hours were counting through the university. I have not heard anything about licensing actually from any of the other interns lately.
I do have a couple more questions, and I think that we will need to move on because this is going to be over at noon. We have to stop. So, Dr. Cunha, you provided only pay information for, I believe, a 6-month period. Who does your taxes?
I have a family member, an accountant who does the taxes.
Okay. Would they then not need that information to fill out your tax returns for your business?
Yes, they would have in the past, and going through to clarify that they also did all of the taxes for anything that would have been listed as Grandis Health as well.
Correct. And that's what I mean, your business taxes. So they would. So they would have information regarding any pay that would have been made during that time period.
Yes. Is there a question as to not enough information provided or going back far enough or anything like that?
Yes, absolutely. Because for taxes, we're required to keep information for at least 7 years.
Yes. And I do recall that the issue was going through, and I would have had at the time, I do remember this issue now, I'm sorry, was going through if anything had been sent through Zelle or Venmo, that they were only going to hold them for the 6 months. And that's why there was a problem with pulling things before, but that would have been not related to my taxes because the taxes would have been filed within that time. So that it has not made an issue then, but it has become an issue since then because I've
contacted. But my point is, wouldn't your accountant then have the information because they needed it to file the taxes?
Oh, I'm sure that yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. So could you not get the information then from the accountant in terms of what was paid for what period for each one of those people? Because they need to have it. They need to have it for 7 years. It has not been 7 years.
Right. Right. I'm sure that they do then. Yes. So that would be somewhere that I could obtain that information if that is needed. Okay. That honestly had not occurred to me.
Okay. Are there any further questions for Dr. Cuneo before we go into the deliberations? Ms. Gavin, do you have a comment? Okay.
I did not, sorry.
Dr. Seidman?
Would you like me to start the deliberation?
Yes, go ahead. So the committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is a time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any other individuals. Dr. Seidman, would you please begin the deliberation since you are the lead?
Yes, Madam Chair. I am extremely concerned about the structure of the training program that Grandis Health has been doing for a while now. It looked like there were a number of trainees that were at Grandis Health in the past that may have been pulled, that are currently there. I'm not exactly sure if there are current trainees, but I'm extremely concerned, and here's why. I believe there's been a number of ethical code violations, of which 2.03 is the number one, I believe, maintaining competence as a training director and clinical supervisor. 3.08, exploitive relationships. I believe the relationships that have been developed and maintained with a number of trainees have been exploitive. Standard 7.01, design of education and training programs. Ultimately, Dr. Cuneo was responsible for developing and maintaining an effective training program that met both the trainees' educational and licensure requirements, and that clearly in violation. In fact, the harm that was done to the recent applicant, feel horrific about that. What we couldn't accept her application for licensure. APA standard 7.02, descriptions of education and training programs. While there's been attempts at rectifying an internship manual is a piece of paper and not the meat and potatoes of a training program. However, they need to reflect effective training programs and reflect accurately and effectively what those training programs are. In addition, I believe in looking at the statutes in terms of unprofessional conduct, I believe there are a number of items that we need to consider that have been violated, including 16C, making or using statements of a character tending to deceive or mislead. We need to consider J, making a fraudulent or untrue statement to the board or investigator, staff, or consultants. We need to consider M, using fraud, misrepresentation, or deception to obtain or attempt to obtain a psychology license or to pass or attempt to pass a psychology license exam or in assisting another person to do so. Y, exploiting a client or patient, student, or a supervisee. And like I said earlier, DD, violating an ethical standard adopted by the board. That concludes my comments right now.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. Now, would you like to turn that into a motion? Well, let me ask Dr. Sorge, do we have any comments?
I was just going to make that a motion. I defer to Dr. Seidman to do that.
Well, thanks. I'll make a motion to hold on. Let me get my thoughts together, okay?
So it would be to move the complaint number 25-15 be referred to the full board for review of a possible violation, and then all those that you listed prior.
Okay. Would you like me to list those again? So I'd like to make a motion.
Ms. Gavin, do we need...
I think the staff is clear. I have the notes. I think we're good.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
And so that was a motion from Dr. Seidman, and then Stuart...
Dr. Stewart seconded his motion, I believe. Is that correct, yes. Dr. Stewart?
Yes, I second that motion. Yes.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Okay. So here none, I will call for a vote. All in favor of the motion made by Dr. Seidman and seconded by Dr. Stewart, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Okay. Motion carries. Complaint number 25-15 regarding Dr. Cuneo has been referred to the full board for review of the 25, possible violations.
25-11.
I'm sorry. It's 25.
I have two different numbers here. On the investigative report is 25-11, and on agenda is 25-15.
That was a typo.
So it's 25-11, or it's
25-15.
Okay, so 25-15 against Dr. Cuneo has been referred to the full board for review, as stated in the motion that was just passed. The licensee will be notified in writing by board staff in the near future regarding the committee's decision today. And then moving on to the next item.
And just to clarify, Madam Chair, Dr. Cuneo will be notified in writing once a review date has been determined for the board's review.
Yes, correct. When the board will review this case, correct. Thank you. Okay. So seeing no other cases to discuss, our next item on the agenda is adjournment. So as there is no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 11:52 a.m.
Thank you. Thank you.